The Gemara we're about to learn today is quite an astonishing one, and in some ways so astonishing that it was censored from the Shas. There is a whole series of Gemaras that were censored by Christian censors over the years, and if you look at the standard edition of the Shas, the Vilna Shas, you know, all the standard editions, they don't have this Gemara. What you're looking at is one of the few contemporary Shasim that does have the Gemara, and it's drawn from something called Chesronos HaShas, which I will just pass around so you can see what it is. The volume was put together, just take a look at it for your information, put together of all of the censored passages in the Gemara, and these, we know these are legitimate because they appear in other editions of the Shas, Italian editions of the Shas that are not, sort of, weren't incorporated in the Vilna Shas. So they are truly a part of Shas. They were censored like many, many others passages related to Christianity by Christian censors. So what's interesting is that some contemporary editions of Shas have now incorporated it into their Shas. So the one you see, is this is from the Shas Chinantem. Are you familiar with that edition of Shas? Which is like, has like a Hebrew translation on the side. It's a little like a Hebrew art scroll, sort of, but no real commentary. And the Sifta edition of Shas, which we have downstairs, has this in a footnote, in an extensive footnote. But what's interesting is that the way the Sifta did it is so as not to mess up the Tzuras HaDaf, they didn't include it in the Daf itself, but the translation side of the Sifta translated as if it's a part of the Shas. So that was their kind of compromise. The Steinsaltz edition of the Shas also has it. So it, as I guess more new editions of Shas are being published, these deletions are being incorporated, as they should, because this is a part of our Gemara, and it should not be disappear from people who learn. So just by way of background. The Gemara is amazing, as you'll see, because it provides a description for what motivated Yeshu to abandon Yiddishkeit, to abandon Judaism, and eventually become the founder of Christianity. I hardly need to tell you that the advent of Christianity had an incalculable influence on the universe, and I also hardly need to add that it had an incalculably bad impact on Jews in many ways. Pogroms, the Inquisition, the Crusades. Jews have suffered horribly at the hands of Christians. So the founding of Christianity not only created a schism within the Jewish community and led many otherwise observant Jews away from the Mesorah, which is a very bad thing in itself, but it also, over the millennia, had a horrific impact on the lives of Jews in that it led to many gruesome, wide-scale deaths. So if we want to understand how Christianity happened, given the horrible impact it had, it's really interesting to see how the Gemara understood it. So it's a very, very important perspective on this. And you'll see that the Gemara's perspective is really astonishing. But you don't need to believe me. Let's learn the Gemara and you'll see for yourself. So the context of the sugya, I've underlined the first piece, Tana Rabbanan li olam tei smol docha v'yamin mikaremes. In relating to people who are problematic, your yamin should be makare, your right hand should be makare, and your left hand should push them away. In other words, there needs to be an ambivalent, complex, nuanced relationship on the part of a leader, a Rebbe, Rav, with those who are kind of going off the deck, who are problematic in some way. Now, this whole issue has massive repercussions as well for how we deal with, you know, Talmidim who are going off the derech, who are not doing well, who are not fully integrated or having issues. How do you deal with them? Misbehaving. And I, as a dean or a Rosh Hashiva, how do we deal with Talmidim that are problematic? So this Gemara addresses that as well. We'll see what we can learn from the Gemara. Not always easy to derive, you know, pure algorithmic solutions to complicated problems, but it becomes a model for us to think about it. Now, what's interesting is the Gemara first has a whole discussion about Elisha and Gehazi, and Elisha's relationship to Gehazi. Gehazi eventually turned away from the Masorah, and the Gemara provides a long, somewhat convoluted story about how that happened and Elisha's responsibility for Gehazi's problems. I'm not going to learn that now, but that's the context of this Gemara. And if you look at the Chasronus HaShas just for a minute, you'll see, I'm not going to focus on this, but the original version of the Shas said that a person should be small docha min mekareves, lo kalisha should docha po legechazi b'shtei yazayim, and lo k'rabi Yeshua ben parachia should docha po leyeshu b'shtei yadayim. So the Gemara lists these two together. Now, in our Gemara, the way out, my Gemara incorporated the Chasronus HaShas, it doesn't mention that the two of them together. Our Gemara, if you look at it, just as Elisha. But that was the original Girsa. And both of these, clearly, in the Riata de Sugya, clearly make it clear that these are two examples of somebody who did not follow the model of Yamin Mekarev and Smol Dokum. Okay? So now let's learn the Gemara. You see where the arrow is? It's all by way of background. Yeshua ben Prachya Mahi. What's the story with Yeshua ben Prachya where he failed to be Yamin Mekarev Smol Dokum? Now, who is Yeshua ben Prachya? So, Rabbi Yeshua ben Prachya was one of the great Zugos and the Balei HaMesorah. The back side, you'll see, well, I'm going to come to that a little bit later in Pirkei Avos. He's mentioned early on in the Pirkei Avos. I'm taking us Yishocho Kibum Yishim and Sadek, and then Yosef ben Yochanan Yishalayim was in part Yosef ben Yezer Yisruda. We spoke about him last time. Yosef ben Yochanan Yishalayim, the next pair. And then the third pair would be, the first, second pair really, Yeshua ben Prachya and Mitai Har Bailey. So the story is being told about one of the two greatest Gedolim of that generation. We're not talking about, you know, one of 100 Talmidei Chachamim. There were two, the Zugos, two Balei HaMesorah. Without these two Balei HaMesorah, there would be no Judaism today. They were the links in the Mesorah according to Pirkei Avos. So it's crucial to understand we're talking about one of the two greatest Chachamim of the generation. Okay? Now, how does the story unfold? Kidekatlinu Yanai Malka L'Rabbanan. There's a period of time when Yanai persecuted the Chachamim. As a result of that persecution, Azal Yoshua ben Prachya V'yeshu Laxandria Shel Mitzrayim. So Yoshua ben Prachya escaped together with his Talmud, Yeshu, to Alexandria of Mitzrayim. Why do you think that Yeshua ben Prachya took Yeshu? Yeshu being, you know, Yeshu is the Aramaic, really, maybe, I guess, Aramaic word for Jesus. Whenever you see Yeshu in the Mesorah, it's the Jewish word for Jesus. We usually use Yeshu so that we don't have to say the name of somebody who is deified, but I'm just mentioning that to you so you know who we're talking about. So why do you think he took Yeshu?
He wanted to keep him close.
Yeah, okay, maybe. Okay. Any other thoughts?
They were never be Talmud.
Exactly. He was, the Pshat is that he was his Talmud Mubar. He was a very close Talmud. And when a Rebbe is Gola, your Talmud is Gola together with the Rebbe, your Talmud, Rebbe with the Talmud. And he was like very, very close to him. And so if he went into Golas, a close Talmud would accompany him. You know, Rebbeim don't go unaccompanied. It's actually the Gemara. It's a halacha that a Talmud Chacham is not supposed to go unaccompanied. So when a Rebbe goes somewhere, he takes a Talmud. Like, for example, you see a Rebbe. You don't see it so much amongst Litvish or Rosh Yeshivas, or maybe nowadays with the Hasidicization of the Litvish Rosh Yeshiva hood, you know, and a lot of elements of Hasidus are floating into the Yeshivish world. But, you know, typically, you know, Rosh Yeshiva will go where he goes. He doesn't necessarily have a bunch of people accompanying him. But halachically, it's supposed to be the case that a great time a Rebbe should have somebody with him. And so he took his Talmud, Yeshu. Now, what does it tell you about Yeshu on that reading of this beginning of the story? What does it tell you about Yeshu?
He wanted to go.
Man, I don't know if he wanted to go. Maybe it was, of course, he probably wanted to go.
He could have been one of the next Zubos.
Exactly. If he was so close to this great Gadol, he must have been a really tremendous person. So right off the bat, we're getting, I think, pretty sympathetic reading of Yeshu. Not what you would expect. I mean, not what you would kind of expect in an art scroll or whatever. I don't mean to knock art scroll, but, you know, a more sanitized version. You know, Russia, Russia, Russia. When he was 2 years old, he was a Russia. When he was 4, he was a Russia. When he was 8, he looked like, you know, that's the negative image of a Tamakoth of the Hajj. You know, he was 2, he was a Baki Bishas. When he was 6, he was a Baki Bishas. So Russia, when he was 2, he was a Russia. When he was 4, he was a Russia. You know, the Havdil. But, you know, there is this kind of maybe oversimplification of the way real life works. And at least the way this Gemara appears, Yeshu was, had the potential for being a great person. He was the Talmud of one of the two greatest Gedolim of his era. Yeshua ben Prague. So that's, right off the bat, pretty interesting and a little surprising, I would say. Right? Wouldn't you agree with me? Okay, let's continue. Ki havashalma, when peace emerged, shalach Shimon ben Shetach, who was the gadol remaining in Yerushalayim, a message to Yeshua ben Prachi. Mini Yerushalayim ir hakodesh, from me, Yerushalayim ir hakodesh, lichi Alexandria, to you, Alexandria shel Mitzrayim, achosi ba'ali shari b'sochech. My sister, my husband, is dwelling between you. In other words, Yerushalayim is saying that my sister, my master, my husband is living with you, namely Yeshua ben Prachia, which is a very poetic, beckoning way to convince Yeshua ben Prachia it's time to come back home. He has the cities communicating. Isn't that a beautiful metaphor? He doesn't say, it's not like Shimon ben Shetach says, would you please come back home? I need you. We need you. He has Yerushalayim communicating to Alexandria. And Yerushalayim is saying, oh, Machosi, Bali, you know, what's a city without a Talmud Chacham? Without a Gadol Hador? You know, you're in Alexandria, we need you here in Yerushalayim, we need our Chachamim to rebuild the life of Torah in Yerushalayim. V'anochi yosheves shomema, I, Yerushalayim, I'm sitting desolate without my Talmud Chacham. Okay, it was pretty persuasive. Come, Asa. So, Rabbi Shimon ben Prachia got up, came, Nisrami Leahu Spiza. And so it was a journey, if you can think of the map. Alexandria is the north, is like an island sort of north of, it's a port. It's north of, a port, the very northern tip of Egypt. That's over there, Africa. Got to swing all the way down and come across to Eretz Yisrael. It's a pretty long journey. So he stopped off at an inn, Abdullah Yikara, and they Kutuba, and they hosted him with great honor. Not clear exactly why. It's kind of interesting because how did they know he was such a great man? They probably weren't Jewish, but they treated him royally. Maybe the way he carried himself, maybe he had a reputation, but Abdullah Yikara, they treated him royally. Amar, so he said, Kama Yafa Aksan Yuzo. How nice is this inn and the hosts who run it? Kama Yafa Aksan Yuzo. Okay. Amale, so Yeshu said, Rebbe, Eineha Trutos, but her eyes are round. Rashi translates Trutos, Agulos. Other Mefarshim translated to mean her eyes are like not attractive, they're dripping, they're not nice. Amale. So Rabbi Shimon ben Prachia says, Russia! You Russia! The Kacha to Osek? Is this what you're busy with? How attractive this Achsanya is? Apik Arba Meyashipure Vishamse. He threw out 400 bolts of lightning. You know, it's a light. This is like a kind of a curse. And he cursed him. Whoa. Pretty harsh, wouldn't you say? There's a misunderstanding. Right? How did Yeshu understand what Yeshua ben Prachya meant when he praised Kama Yafach San Yezo? He understood it to mean that the hostess of the Aksanya was pretty. All right, I hear. You know, okay. That's not what Yeshua ben Prachya meant.
Wouldn't that still be a problem? I mean, like, the fact that he thought that he meant that still be a problem, no?
What do you mean?
That's just showing where his mind's at. Like,
It's exactly correct. That's why Yeshua ben Prachya cursed him with 400 bolts of light. Now, I got it that maybe he shouldn't have interpreted it in that way, and he shouldn't have been focused on how pretty the waitress was, the hostess was. But would you say that this draconian, horrific curse with 400 bolts of light or whatever is the kind of natural response to that? I mean, he misunderstood him. Okay, maybe it tells you something about where his head was at. But it doesn't seem excessively harsh. So that's, of course, the theme that starts the theme of Yamin Makari of Ismol Dofa, right? This is yes.
We don't really know the nature of their relationship or the nature of that curse, for that matter. So it's hard for us to really put a judgment on that. We don't know what their conversations were like. We don't know what he should have been expecting from Yeshu based on their prior discussion.
Okay, that's definitely a good point. We don't have the background. Right. Well, it's a very harsh thing, I can assure you. If it appears elsewhere in Shas, it's a sign of a super harsh curse. So, obviously, this triggered in Yeshua ben Prachya an enormously intense negative reaction towards Yeshu. And the story really continues. Maybe before we analyze it, we have to see how it continues. But you're absolutely right. We don't have a background. Mendy is correct. You'll see the Yad Raman. Well, let's read the Yad Raman. Underline here for a second. You see where it's underlined at the bottom? Biur HaRishonim. Don't get any ideas, please. Curse it, don't curse it. And the brothers, you know. You see where it's underlined? De'ilo hava adik behu ba'aveira. It's hard to read. I can take off my glasses. If he wasn't already attached to aveira, lo havi chashed le Yeshua ben Prachya b'ach. So the Yad Ramah surmises that there was some history of Averis on the part of Yeshu, which led Yeshua ben Prachya to react so negatively, which is really partly Mendy's point, like what's the background. But what's the Yad Ramah's evidence? What's his raya for that claim?
He was thinking that way.
What's the Yad Ramah's raya? What's his evidence that there must have been something in the past? Exactly. The Yad Ramah is answering the kasha I asked. The kasha I ask is, what could justify such a horrific response, or some draconian response? The Yad Ramah says, there must have been something going on in the past, but we don't know what it is. I'm going to suggest to you a solution to that in a minute, but before I do that, let's continue with the Gemara. But the kasha is a serious kasha. It's a very serious kasha. Yes?
So you translated Shemte as cursed them. Elsewhere in Shas, it's used to mean putting it to Cherem, like in Shabbos, or Lezer Shemuel.
Yes, it's a curse for Cherem. Mm-hmm. These 400 bolts, these 400 is like is a very harsh way of putting something in Cherem. That's exactly correct. Shantai is a kind of Cherem. It's a very harsh Cherem, and it has a kind of a curse attached to it, in this case. Okay, let's continue. Asa lakame kama zindim. So Yeshu came again and again to his Rebbe Yeshua ben Prachya, Amalei, and he said to him, Kablan, accept me. He's doing tshuva. He comes back to his Rebbe, abashed, shamefaced, penitent. He feels terrible. Kablan, lahava mashkapeh, he didn't pay any attention. Refused to even attend to Yeshu's attempts to express his remorse. Does he say that he didn't accept him? What does it say? Does it say lo kablan? No, he says lo ashkachbe. What's the difference?
Showed apathy. He just ignored him.
Yeah, he just ignored him. He didn't pay any attention. That's even harsher. It's like if you hear somebody who wants their tshuva out, you say, no, I'm still not ready to mekabel you, I'm still not ready to mekabel you. Okay, I hear that. But Yeshua and Prachi didn't even listen to it, which is also a very harsh response to a Talmud, A, close Talmud, B, who traveled with him for months or years, C, who's begging to do tshuva. Very, very harsh. Okay, let's continue. Yom Achad Havakar Kari Kriyashma. One day, Yeshua ben Prachi was saying Kriyashma. Asa Lakame. And yet again, Yeshu came before him. Change of heart. Savar Lakbule. Finally, for reasons totally unexplained, Yeshua ben Prachi decides finally, to accept his Talmud in Shuvah. Achvalei biyadei. You're not allowed to talk when you say Kriya Shema. So he showed him, he moved his hands to say, like, wait a minute, or something like that. Some form of nonverbal communication, like, wait a minute, come back, in a few minutes, let me finish Kriya Shema, I can't. Very good, hold the fingers together. Yeah. So, Hu savar, minchi dachi. Before there was a misinterpretation of verbal communication, now there is an even more tragic misinterpretation of nonverbal communication. You know, the motioning of hands is even less clear frequently than words. So here we have a doubling over of miscommunication. Husavar Michidachila, he interpreted that motion with the hands was, you're finished, you're out. He's pushing him away again. Azal Zakif Levinta, he went up, he went, Yeshu, he threw up an image of the moon, Vishtach of Allah, and he bowed down to it. Amalei. So Yeshua ben Prachi says to him, Hadarbach, cut it out. Do tshuva. What are you doing worshiping in Avodah Zarah? Amalei kach mikublani mimach. This is what I learned from you. Kol achot ayomach deyes harabim. Whoever sins and causes others to sin, ein maspikin biyado la'asos tshuva. You no longer do tshuva. You've taught me that me in my current state, now that I've bowed down to a levana and perhaps also encouraged others to do so, because he says Chote Yumachti as a Rabbin. Ain must speak in the Yadol Biat Lasas Tshuva. That person can no longer do tshuvas. So he turns his Rebbe's teaching against his Rebbe. This is an ironic twist. His Rebbe now wants him to do tshuva. So look at the way in which this evolved. Misunderstanding. Rebbe gets very angry. Talmud tries to do tshuva. Rebbe refuses to pay any attention to him. When the Rebbe wants to accept him tshuva, another misunderstanding, and now the Talmud quotes the Rebbe telling him, you want me to do tshuva? You've taught me yourself that I can't do tshuva. Very tragic unfolding of the dual misunderstandings as a consequence of the ambiguity of verbal and nonverbal communication. Okay.
Jeez, Obel,
yeah.
How do we know Yeshu wouldn't have said that the first time? The first time he came and wanted to be accepted, how do you know if Rabbi Yeshua ben Prachi accepted, he would have said the same thing? Oh, now
he was not chote yet. The first time he had not yet bowed down.
After he said he.
But he had not yet done any averus.
He
had not.
But he was still trying to do tshuva.
Yes, then he was trying to do tshuva. Now he says, now that I've crossed the Rubicon, I can no longer do tshuva. I've made a crucial step away from Yiddishkeit. I'm lost. And you've taught me I'm lost, which is such a. It's so ironic, it kind of using the Rebbe's teaching against the Rebbe, which is, have you ever seen Talmidim do that? It happens sometimes, you know. You Rebbe said that, that's why I'm doing this. Yes.
So maybe I missed it, but where do we see that Yeshu was Machti Asarabim?
That's what I was saying. No, he doesn't. It's not clear. That's what I'm saying. It could be that when he bowed down to the Levana, or to this image of the Levana, he encouraged others around him.
Mm-hmm.
He was obviously historically, we know he was obviously a very charismatic man. And we see from this Agada that he was very talented because he was a Talmud of the Gadol Hador, one of the two Gadolei Hador of that generation. So he was talented and charismatic. It's not surprising that when he broke away, there were, maybe he had followers, maybe something was going on already as he was, you know, fomenting something before he actually split from his Rebbe. So there was an element. He himself says, Kotu Machtis Ram. It's not made clear, but that's what I guess we have to conjecture. And the Agada to concludes, the Amar, this is a different, this is an appendage to the Agadita. This is a Kuda. This is not the author of the Agadita itself. This is the Gemara adding something. Amar, you know, you need to be sensitive to these things when you learn Agadita or you learn Gemara generally, how the pieces fit together. There's a story, now we have a Kuda to the story, added much later to the story. Amar, Yeshu Kishef V'hisis V'diach Es Yisrael. He was a witchcraft, he performed witchcraft, and he was Mesis Umediach, and he brought people away from Klal Yisrael. Now, we don't know the date of this original Agadita, forget about the Coda. I don't know how close it was to the story itself, and I don't know how far Christianity evolved into a separate religion. You know, it's important for you to understand that historically, in the early, early phases of Christianity was, it wasn't a separate religion. It was one sect within Judaism. They thought of themselves as Jews who had certain beliefs in the divinity of Yeshu and his resurrection, but they thought of themselves as being Jews, like the Jews for Jesus today. That's a reversion back to the original, the early, early stages of Christianity. They thought of themselves, and Yeshu was a Talmud Chacham, apparently. He was a very learned person. So it's hard to know exactly at what stage this Agadita is told. You know, how far had Christianity separated itself? Separation was influenced by St. Paul. It had a lot to do with their attempt to convert many pagans, and the focus on spirituality and away from Kiyum HaMitzvos made it a lot easier to convert pagans, right? It's hard to convert people if you have to circumcise the males. And if you have to, you know, keep kosher and all the many halachas. So Christianity, for theological and also pragmatic reasons, evolved into a separate religion in which they rejected their Jewishness and, of course, eventually persecuted the Jews, eventually. You know, the Rambam, by the way, famously has a positive explanation for the role of Christianity in the history of the world. You know that? It's not in the classic editions of the Mishnah Torah. Guess why? Knew why?
Censored.
Was censored, right? But in the Frankel edition and the newer editions of the Mishnah Torah, it appears, the Rambam, who says that Christianity in Yeshu was a disaster, which he was, says that nevertheless it plays a role in the overall unfolding Hashgacha of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Am I ringing any bells? You know why that is? The Rambam says that that Christianity spread belief in a God as opposed to paganism throughout the world. Now, precisely because they rejected the mitzvos, that it, as I mentioned, it made, you know, the marketing pitch easier. But the Rambam sees in that in the flow of Christianity over the civil over the world, bringing belief in God and undercutting paganism to have been a part of the divine Hashgacha. Now, that's not this Gemara, but this Gemara, the Rambam's account, which is very, very interesting, just in its own right, worth thinking about, it's not a subject for right now, but this Gemara also has a very sympathetic portrait of Yeshu. In other words, one way to read this Gemara, and this is what's so, well, I started by saying this is an amazing Gemara, because what accounts for Christianity? What's the overall theme of the Gemara? Te smol docha v'yamin makare. Which is the stronger hand?
Right.
The right hand. What's the message of the Gemara there when it comes to balancing, punishing an errant Talmud with being makare of an errant Talmud? What's the balance of the two, and what is implied by the two hands, nu,
you should be more
kiruv than richuk. You should, you know. And so the overall, and look what happened to Elisha and Gehazi. So what's the overall thrust of this Gemara? The overall thrust of this Gemara is to attribute, is in a sense, at some level, to blame. I wouldn't say it, but the Gemara seems to be saying that that's the flow of the sugya. Blame Yeshua ben Prachya for not abiding by Svol Docha and Yemin Nekare. Yes, exactly. That's it. In other words, the Gemara is giving two examples. Exactly, you're exactly correct. In the original Kasronos Hashas, the Gemara is explicit in giving two examples of how Yeshua ben Prachya being one of them, where he didn't follow Yemin Nekare. So, you know, it's just astonishing to me that this Gemara attributes Christianity in part to a failure of the Jewish community, of the leader of the Jewish community. Would you ever have thought that? You know, Yeshu, terrible, terrible, terrible. He's portrayed as a Talmud of Yeshua ben Prachya, the Gadol Hadar. He's portrayed as being acted upon overly harshly by his Rebbe. And that resulted, that excessive harshness resulted in the founding of Christianity. Now, the Gemara here was written clearly before the Crusades and before the Inquisition, before the horrible persecutions that Christians inflicted upon the Jews. Would the Gemara have said the same, had the same message with the hindsight of history? It's hard to say. If you ask me, this is no more. I can't answer the question definitively, right? My guess is yes, because this is the Gemara's assessment of what happened historically.
It probably strengthens the point. There are extreme consequences.
Right, exactly. And this is really a Musar Haskel, by the way, for you become, some of you will become Rabbanim, Rabbeim, Rosh Hashivas, whatever, you know, or leaders of the Jewish community, you know, principal of the school, chairman of the board of the school, whatever, president of the school, or yeshiva, you may play a role in this. And the Gemara is really very, very concerned about the impact of being excessively harsh in the Talmud. It doesn't say, by the way, that the smol should not be docha. The Gemara does not provide a simplistic formula for dealing with an errant, rebellious Talmud. There's got to be a smol docha. There's got to be some discipline. And it's very hard to know how to balance the two. I was discussing this Gemara just after davening with Rabbi Bamberger, and he mentioned to me a story that he heard about the Chafetz Chaim, which is quite interesting. I'll share it with you. Can't attest to the historicity of the story, but the story is famous. It may not be true, but it's famous. And the story goes that Chafetz Chaim summoned in a well-known, experienced veteran menahel in that part of the world, you know, in Lithuania, Belarus, and was retired and a very distinguished menahel. And he came over to him and he told him, and he called him, summoned him, and the menahel came, and he told the menahel, "I want you to know that because of you, millions of Jews have left from Kite." So Menahel looked at him like he was this distinguished Menahel of the yeshiva for decades. "What do you mean they left?" He said, "You had a Talmud by the name of Leib Trotsky." Does that ring a bell? Trotsky. Who was Trotsky?
Leon Trotsky.
Yeah, Leon Trotsky was one of the founders of communism. And you kicked him out of the yeshiva. You were very harsh with him. As a result of that, he left Yiddishkeit, and he was one of the founders of communism, and communism led hundreds of thousands or millions of young Jews in Europe away from Yiddishkeit. So that's, the Chafetz Chaim somehow knew, according to this story, that he was a kind of a Yeshua ben Prachya figure. And that echoes throughout Jewish history, and it's a Musar Haskel to those of us, myself included, who run an institution. How do you balance the two? And I have no, as I say, there's no clear answer to it. And the Gemara, I want to stress, does the Gemara give us an answer? Gemara does not. The Gemara just says you have to balance the two. A little more on the kiruv side, but there has to be a small dovah. You can't have a hefkervel. You can't have, you know, Talmidim going off and doing terrible things. It can ruin the yeshiva. So the Gemara is, in fact, leaving us with a Musar Haskel about the importance of being Makarev, but not telling us to ignore the importance of discipline. I have a number of, we have to end soon, and I have a number of things to say about the Gaudete, but I'll take quick comments. Yes?
Maybe he said that he really was trying to be Makar to him, and that I'm saying, if we're going based on what Bir Rishonim say, that
that's the Abraham.
The Yeshu was already, like, clearly already going down. Why do you bring Alexandria with him?
Okay, great. So that's, I'm glad you made that point, because it's a perfect segue into my next one. So we didn't plan it, but great job. So here's what I want to suggest. The Abrahama conjectures that he must have seen something going on with Yeshu, but you could ask, well, why did he take him with him to Alexandria? So I think the answer to that question, and what this is a conjecture too. There's no intratextual evidence for it, and no raya from the text itself, but this is a conjecture which to me makes sense. Anybody know anything about Alexandria in the ancient world?
Cultural meeting place of all the different societies.
It was a center of Hellenistic culture.
It flags the misbehaviors.
So it was such a huge shul that you couldn't see Sigmar Brachas. You couldn't see it, so that you didn't know when to say, okay, so I left out a play. It was a wealthy, Hellenized Jewish community. Their level of knowledge of Tar Shabbal Peh was not great. We have evidence of that from various sources, from Philo and other sources. I mean, they had some Sora, obviously. But they kind of like missed, you know, Bavel and the whole, you know, the Eretz Yisrael, because they were off to the side. They were, like you might say, this sounds overly simplistic, so you'll excuse me, but you might say that I don't mean this to be negative, but like a really large Orthodox shul on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. Mm-hmm. You know, beautiful, aesthetically attractive, very sophisticated, very wealthy, observant. Go to shul, but very aesthetically informed culture. Alexandria was, the architecture was beautiful, the huge shul, as Mendy says, a beautiful shul. It was a very cosmopolitan, as you said, culture, people, it was a center of trade, had the biggest library of all, which was eventually destroyed in a great tragedy. They collected the works of all the wise people in the world. It was really a extraordinary city. Now, let's imagine. Yeshua ben Prachya, Godol Hador, huge Talmud Chacham, he comes to Alexandria. Do you think he's going to be influenced by Alexandrian culture? Probably not. But wait a minute. He's got this young Talmud Yeshu, gifted, talented, charismatic, close to his Rebbe, intellectually accomplished and sophisticated, as a Talmud of Yeshua ben Prachya would have to be. Maybe he wasn't ready for the enchantments, aesthetic and otherwise, of the culture of Alexandria. And maybe as they were heading back to Eretz Yisrael, Yeshua ben Prachya detected in his Talmud Yeshu an appreciation of beauty, sophistication of Alexandrian culture all along. And then when Yeshu says, but she's not beautiful, what did Yeshua ben Prachya see in that? What he saw in that is that Yeshu became infected by the cultural attitudes, the respect for beauty that he found in Alexandria, and Yeshu was no longer the good yeshiva bachar of Yerushalayim. He had spent too much time in Alexandria. And that's why he reacted so negatively, because he saw in his Talmud something that really disturbed him. And this was this assimilation, shall we say, into the cultural and aesthetic values of the great Hellenistic city of Alexandria. And because he saw that Yeshu was so talented, knew he was so talented, he had to take dramatic action. He couldn't allow this to go any further from his perspective, because he knew the talent of his Talmud. And he had to be tough, because he saw, it wasn't just, oh, she had pretty eyes. Oh, which is the way it's usually is, he was a Baal Taiva. There's no evidence, by the way, that Yeshu was a Baal Taiva historically, other than this text. And I don't, Christianity, early Christianity was pretty ascetic, by the way. Early Christianity was ascetic. The early Christianity whichever to this very day, Roman Catholic priest. Are they allowed to marry? No, there was a strong monastic living that early Christianity, early Christians lived, many of them lived in monasteries. It was a very ascetic life. So I don't know if there's any evidence that early Christianity was particularly inflicted with the Yetzer Hara. That's why I tend to see in Yoshua ben Prachya's response a critique, not so much of Baal Taiva, maybe was, but a critique of this cultural shift of allegiance away from the Mesorah and in favor of Alexandrian Hellenistic culture. I just want to, it's getting a little late, and we have to jump to Pirkei Avos, so we have to look at Pirkei Avos. I just want to make a couple of comments about, very brief, because we don't have time, about what's this bowing down to the Levana? Christians were not pagans. And Yeshu, there's no evidence that he himself, you know, worshipped idols, that they fought against that, you know, over time. So what's this bowing down to a Levana? I mean, I really, it's a good question. I don't have any certain answers. I'll just throw out a couple of answers to you. It could be that early Christianity, as it sought to proselytize, allowed certain elements of paganism into their practices so as to get more pagans into the fold. So maybe there was an element of that as a part of the eurythmic. You know, it's hard to totally eliminate paganism. What does the Gemara say about how the eighth strong, the eighth Sahara for Avodah Zarah was? Who had it eliminated? Antichesegdola. It was just so powerful. So when they were trying to proselytize, maybe they allowed a certain element of paganism in it. It could be that the Levana is symbolically the Lord of the Night, which is how Chazal chose to see Yeshu as the Lord of the Night. Darkness, you know, advent of darkness in the history of Judaism, Yiddishkeit. Also, another way to think about this is that what's the relationship between the Levana and the Shemesh?
Reflection.
Yes, so maybe Judaism is the Shemesh and the Levana is the, Christianity is kind of like the child, the Shemesh, the Levana to the Judaism. Anyway, these are just conjectures, just things. But we must look at the, turn the page, the other side of the page. We don't have much of the way of teachings of Yeshua ben Prachya, but we do have in Pirkei Avos. So look at the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. Yeshua ben Prachya, Venitai Har Bailey, Kiblu Mehem, he was the other Zug. Yeshua ben Prachya, Omer, Asei Lecha Rav, Ukenei Lecha Chaver, Vehavidonis Kol Adam Lachavschus. Make yourself a Rebbe, acquire for yourself a friend, and be done as Kol Adam Lachavschus. What's the Kasha?
He didn't judge Yeshu.
Exactly. Would you say that Yeshua and Prachy was done as Yeshu l'chavschus? What?
He saw by his actions he was not doing well.
Okay, but it wasn't as if he had over an Averis, he hadn't done anything wrong yet. All he said is he had pretty eyes. He could have interpreted it differently. So, here's what I hear what you're saying, but here's what I suggest. That this Mishnah...
Yeshu didn't judge him with Gospels.
That's also true.
He learned from his mistakes.
Exactly! Very good! How do we know when the Mishnah was written?
When Rabbi compiled it.
Yeah, I know, but what... No, I'm sorry, you're correct. Let me rephrase it, because I phrased it inaccurately. How do we know when Yeshu ben Prachya taught this? When did he come to realize the importance of having done this Kol Adam L'chavschus? So, my kasha was that the teaching preceded the experience. The Teretz, I think, is a plausible one, is that it followed the experience. Yeshua ben Prachya was a great man. I mean, he was a Gadol Hador. People make mistakes. Most of us, when we make mistakes, we don't learn from them. We just keep on going. The Musar Haskel here is that a Gadol Hador, if he admits to mistakes, learns something. And he came to see, on this interpretation, I'm not sure, but this is what I would say, so he came to see how important it is to me, because look what happened. Christianity got founded because he was not done his chalot, his time of l'chavschus. How do you understand in the context, asei l'cha rav? What's that? Yeah, of course. Does that connect to the story with Yeshu? And this to me is a very...
Is this a criticism of Yeshu?
Well, Yeshu did make a Rebbe for himself. He slept with him to Alexandria. What?
And he tried.
And he tried. And what I think I would suggest to you is that Asei Lecha Rav, and you got to think about this yourself in your own life. Asei Lecha Rav is something that's very important, but I think it's ironically undercut by the very story of Yeshu and Yeshua ben Prakhya. Why? Let's say Yeshu had never accompanied Yeshua ben Prakhya to Alexandria. It never made him such a Rebbe that he would be a shamus and would go with him wherever he went. What would have Yeshu's fate have been?
I would have left.
In Israel.
He would have stayed in Israel. He would have become the next Rosh Hashiva, the next Gadol Hador. Making for yourself a Rebbe is very important, but it's a hazardous choice. And maybe you should have chosen Nitan Harbeli as a Rebbe, who would have been a little less tough on it. In other words, Aseh L'chara. But Rabbi Shimon ben Prakhya and Yeshu's story teaches us that there is a hazard to that relationship, and that relationship can have cataclysmic consequences if it's not handled properly, where the Rebbe does not don the skalat of the skaskus, where the Rebbe, hear me, the Rebbe is not the karev biyamin, and that Aseh L'chara destroyed Yeshu enough. Plus, if you're close to a Rebbe, and you're a Talmud Muvak of your Rebbe, Rebbe has high expectations of you. I would imagine that Yeshua ben Prakhya had very high expectations of his Talmud Yeshu. If you're close to a Rebbe, you're really close, you go to a shir and you learn with him all the time, he expects something of you. And those expectations, if they aren't met, can yield a harsh response from a Rebbe. What do you mean? You're supposed to have known Maseches Bava Kamma by now. All the Sakhla Vitaria. What are you, you're busy, you know, go to ball games, watch the Super Bowl?
Go to class.
Go to class. Fortunately, here there are babes who support that. But, in other words, what I'm saying, and here's a message I want to leave you with, is that Aseh L'charav is important, powerful, but fraught. It's a complicated relationship. It creates expectations for a Talmud. And if the Rebbe isn't quite right, it can destroy the Talmud. Every Talmud needs a Rebbe. But every Talmud must choose a Rebbe who will be Mekarev B'Yamin and not and only Docha B'Smol. Has to be Docha B'Smol, but never be Docha B'Yamin and Mekarev B'Smol. I don't have an explanation for that. I don't know if it fits in. And I'm not sure that I say the Harav fits in, but I do know that this story certainly sheds light on the complexity of a Seyla Harav. And Kneel Chachar may just have been one of his teachers. So, a Seyla Harav, choose a Rebbe, but choose a Rebbe with great wisdom and care.